Thanks so much. Yeah, and thanks for organizing also this conference. It's been really fun so far. So indeed, it's going to be sort of the follow-up on what David was talking about, the more SDP-related part. But in the end, the question I'm trying to answer is the same. The motivation is similar. But it has, in general, slightly more applications than David just mentioned. So this is the outline of what I'm going to talk about. So I'll keep the introduction pretty short because, well, David was a very elaborate introduction basically to this talk as well. I'll restate this quantum polynomial optimization problem that David also showed, and then the meat of the presentation will be how to actually put this into a computer. Okay. So the motivation, again, comes from the very famous Bell scenario, for example, where we have Alice and Bob, and they have their POVMs, right? So these are positive operator-valued measures, and they should sum to the identity to make sure that this becomes a probability. And we are given some probabilities that follow from combining these POVMs with the state in this way, right? So this is the same notation that David used, where our state is now a functional on operators from some algebra. And to make this a state, we need that it's normalized. So when you act on the identity, it outputs one. And it needs to be a positive semi-definite operator, positive functional. Okay, but so with this, we want to answer a more general question, not only in the Bell scenario, but more generally for causal structures or for DAGs. Given some conditional probability distribution or just some general probability distribution, determine whether it is compatible with some causal structure that you consider. Okay, and this is, of course, very dependent also on which physical model you prescribe to. Do you just consider classical probability, or do you also look at quantum mechanics, generalized probabilistic theories? And we've seen kind of all of these examples throughout the week already, right? Okay, so a second application of these polynomial things is nonlinear Bell inequalities. So again, Bell inequalities we've also already seen this week. The most famous one would be the CHSH inequality, right, which you can express as a linear expression in the state, right? The row enters only once here, and then you get a polynomial in the operators. But this, I mean, this we already did and could do and know a lot about. Right? So in the classical case, this is upper bounded by 2. In the quantum case, it's upper bounded by 2 square root of 2. A lot about this is already known. But we could also now, with this new approach, optimize over expressions like this, where now rho comes in with a square on top as well. So now we have these sort of two kinds of polynomials in one expression. And for this one, it was known that the classical bound is 4. And recently, like in this Klepp paper that David also alluded to already, they showed that the quantum bound is actually matching. So maybe this particular equality or inequality is not so interesting because the classical and quantum cases actually are the same for this bound. But you can think of many more more complicated expressions in like non-linear Bell inequalities. Okay, I mean, yeah, there are so many you can think up or construct and see whether classical and quantum has a separation there. Okay, so in particular, we want to apply these things to several causal structures as well. So we've seen the bilocal scenario, we've seen the triangle scenario. This is just some weird causal structure that I cooked up. But in general, you can think of any causal structure or like any DAG you like, and try to. Right. This looks like one of these weird elusive ones, indeed. but in general, we want to apply this to any DAG that you can create with quantum states and measurements at the end. Okay, and in particular, also like David said, the ones we like are the ones that look something like this. So either like a line or like a star, like Ellie alluded to as well. And the reason is that we can write independence conditions for these in a very nice way, namely such that they relate to how the state factorizes. Okay, so in the left one, we have that the state acting on the A system should factorize with respect to how it acts on the C and D systems, right? Because like if you would remove the node B, then there's no way of like A and C, D being correlated with each other. And similarly, if you would remove the node C, you also see that the state should factorize over the splitting A, B, and D. And on the right-hand side, it's something similar, right? So if you would remove the A system here, then all of these B, C, D, E systems, they should also factorize like this. Now, why is that nice? Well, these expressions are actually polynomials in two ways.
Ask a quick question.
Yeah, of course.
Are you claiming that these are necessary and sufficient conditions to describe what sort of state over four parties can be realized by this algebra, or these are just necessary but maybe insufficient?
So yeah, that's a good question. So in this case, we don't know yet whether it's sufficient, right? So this is also what David was talking about. If you have the bilocal scenario, then it's necessary and sufficient.
Okay.
And then you would only have sort of one of these, right? Only A and C separating into two parts. For this one, for the one on the right, we also know that it is sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
But for the line, we think it is, but we're not sure yet. We're trying to figure it out.
Okay, I feel like I have a thought that it's not, but we can figure it out.
Okay, I would be very interested in that. But yeah, let's talk about that after, I guess. Okay, so such expressions are polynomials in two ways, like David said, namely in the operators, but also in the state, in this way, right? So you can express this condition that we had for the star networks as like a fourth order polynomial in the state. Okay, and such expressions I will call state polynomials for the rest of this talk, right? State polynomials means polynomials in two ways, having operator polynomials as well as the commutative polynomials over the state. So now we can write this down more abstractly in the language that David was using as a minimization problem over some objective function, some polynomial objective function, subject to polynomial constraints in these algebras and these states. Okay, and in particular, the two examples that I gave can be expressed in such a way. Okay, so for example, A could be the algebra generated by the measurements, and the PI, the constraints, could be the factorization constraints of the state. Okay, and now we want to tackle this problem with the help of convex optimization. So in particular, semi-definite programming, and that looks something like this in general. So what semi-definite programming can do is it can optimize over some matrix X, and then you can take a trace inner product with respect to some matrix that you care about, subject to constraints of the same type, where the matrix X is supposed to be positive semi-definite. So this can be done efficiently in the size of the matrix, where efficiently should be taken with a grain of salt, because it still means that in practice the matrices cannot exceed like maybe like 3,000 by 3,000 size, right? So in practice you actually reach limits pretty quickly, but still there's a lot you can do with this. Now the difficulty is that our problem is not convex at all a priori. So we have three reasons why this is difficult. At first, so the set of product states that we're trying to optimize over, right, these products of the state row, this is not a convex thing. Like these polynomials are not convex. You can see this very quickly by noting that if you have two product states, rho and sigma, then taking a convex combination of them is no longer a product state, but a mixed state in general. So that's not nice. let's go to the second reason why it's not nice. The polynomials in the state, and also actually in the operators, can also be non-convex polynomials. Okay, why are we even considering convex optimization at this point, you could ask? Well, it gets worse. The dimension also grows exponentially in, say, the number of qubits or something, right? And like I said, even though convex optimization is efficient, in practice, you cannot do that much in terms of size of the matrix. So that seems pretty bad. Why are we even using this? Well, kind of for all of these three points, there are solutions or like ways of fixing this. So to start with the last point, this was solved a while back in around 2008, 2010 in the NPA hierarchy and NPO. This is a bit confusing, same letters almost, but one is for the names, Navasquez, Pironio, and Asin. And the other one stands for non-commutative polynomial optimization. And this can optimize exactly over over these algebras, basically. The only thing is that we still would have things that are linear in the state. So the types of things that it can optimize over is expressions that are linear in the state, but polynomial in the operators. Okay, so what does it do? It gives you a hierarchy of relaxations that converges in the limit, and each of these relaxations will give you a lower bound for the actual optimization problem that you're looking for. Okay, and the nice thing about this is that it can be formulated regardless of the dimension of the system that you're looking at. Okay, so let's have a look at how it works roughly. So the idea is that you construct a functional that is only positive on a subspace of your algebra. Okay, so what do I mean by that? You can choose a basis of your algebra A. In most cases, this would be considered just like the monomials, the words in the algebra, where typically we put the first one to be the identity. And then you choose some integer k and construct a k by k matrix where at position I, j, the matrix should take the value of a state acting on these operators, on this basis, or like a product of two of these basis elements. Right? This is also, I guess, why we choose A0 to be the identity, because then in the first row and the first column, you would have everything that has only one basis element. And then this matrix should actually be a positive semi-definite matrix. Why? Well, I'll quickly show you. A matrix is positive semi-definite if and only if, when you sandwich it between two vectors, the outcome is non-negative for all vectors v. So we can check whether this is true for our matrix M. And so we can just write out the sum of two for the matrix multiplication. And we can fill in what Mij is, namely this expectation value with respect to these operators. And now we can take the sums and the vi's inside of the state, because this is just all linear. And we call these new sums, we call them x. So now we get a row of x star x, and this is a positive element of the algebra. And so if you evaluate it on a state, then for sure this should be non-negative. Right? So we want our matrix M constructed in this way to be positive semi-definite always. So now we can actually formulate it like this entire thing as an SDP. So it looks a bit daunting maybe, but I'll go through the lines one by one. So the first line is this P0 polynomial constraint, where we just express the polynomial in terms of these basis elements. Of course, you need to choose your basis in a smart way so that this actually looks kind of nice. But the nice thing is, so these are now expressed only in terms of these matrix elements. Okay, on the second line, we put the 0, 0 element to 1. And this is the normalization condition, right? Because if you look at this expression right here, then rho evaluated on the identity should be equal to 1. And that corresponds to the 0, 0 element of the matrix being equal to 1. Okay, then this one should signify like all our polynomial constraints. Okay, so if the PLs are our polynomial constraints, then again you can express this in terms of all the matrix elements that you have in your moment matrix. I forgot to say this is called a moment matrix. And finally, we have this positive semi-definite condition. Right, so it now just consists of linear constraints on this matrix and a positive semi-definite constraint. So this actually solved 1.5 of our 3 problems. Namely, MPO can deal with the fact that things are maybe even infinite dimensional. And it can handle polynomials in the operators, but not in the states. So we've solved kind of half of our problem here. But these two things still seem problematic. And that is kind of sort of the new approach that we looked at. And the motivation for what we're going to do comes from here. So if we have a polynomial in the state like this, so this is one of the simplest polynomials you can think of, right? Then this implies a certain symmetry in a way. Namely, we can have a look at what this does. So you can make a copy of rho on a second tensor product and let it just be evaluating on the identity on the second copy, right? So this would be the same. It's like a bit of a dumb thing to do maybe, but it is true. And if we look at the right side of this equation, we can also express this as rho tensor 2, A tensor B, right? And we could swap these two, and you could see that you also get the same if you do B tensor A. So if you look at this, there is quite a lot of symmetry going on in these operators and in these states. In particular, you can exchange B to sort of the second tensor vector, and your expectation values stay the same. More generally, you can make n copies of the state, and permuting these operators individually over these n copies, this will give you exactly still the same expectation value over factorizing over row AB. Okay, and this idea is also one of the motivations or one of the main motivations for this inflation technique that we've seen before, right? Copying systems and imposing symmetry conditions as sort of a substitute for the factorization or the independence, which is hard to actually implement. Okay, so this is going one way, and actually it's solving part of our difficult problem, because we can now use these tricks to make our polynomials in the state into linear expressions in the state. Okay, so this is how we do it. We have our polynomial optimization problem, and instead we try to solve the following problem, where now we have a state which I call omega, which lives on n copies of our algebra, and it optimizes over only polynomials in the generator or in the operators, right? So there's only linear expressions in the state here and polynomials in the operators. And I'll show you an example of what such a polynomial in the operator looks like. We called them polarizations in our paper. And the idea is like this. So for example, again, if we have our factorization condition between A and B, then the polynomial the polarization that does the same trick is if you have A1 and B1, so like that's the copies of A and B on the first copy, minus A1, B2. So B2 is then the copy of B on the second level, right? So if this would be indeed a product state, then this expression would be exactly equivalent to the other expression. Instead, we only ask for it to be a symmetric state on A tensor N. Okay, so this is in general relaxation, but symmetry is a linear constraint again. So symmetry we can actually put into the computer, and it can deal with that. Okay, so now we've relaxed our problem from here to here, but now it's something we can solve because it looks like one of those MPO problems. Okay, and so now we have sort of solved all three of our problems by relaxing the constraints. We can now deal with symmetric states, and symmetric states are actually convex. the set of symmetric states. All polynomials are sort of linearized, and NPO can deal with infinite dimensional things. Okay, so now at least we know how to put things into a computer. But now we also would like that in the limit, we solve our problem exactly. And for this, we need a following the following theorem, which looks kind of difficult. So I normally only show it very short so that you don't have the time to actually read it. But the idea is that if you have a symmetric state, then if you take the limit of infinite number of copies, then your state actually becomes a separable state. Okay, so the state here, this omega that we were optimizing over, becomes a convex mixture, a convex combination of product states pi sigma on this infinite tensor product. And this is useful because now, like if you were able to pick out one of these states as your actual state, then you would have a product state. Okay, so we already in this step got rid of the entanglement, so to say, that was problematic between the layers. Okay, so I'm going to give a very quick sketch of the proof of convergence of like all the layers, so to say, of the STP hierarchy. So like I said before, each step of the hierarchy is a relaxation. So each solution that you get out, or each value for the objective function that you get out, is at least a lower bound for the actual problem. Now, we know that NPO converges. So that part is already done for us. And now we use the quantum de Fermat theorem to show that in the limit of the number of copies going to infinity, what we get out is actually a separable state. Okay, so the state we get is a separable state over all the copies that we made. And the second part of the theorem is that each of these pi sigmas, where each is between brackets because it's each with respect to the, it's almost everywhere with respect to the measure mu, each of these pi sigmas obeys all of the polynomial constraints that we gave to the computer. And that's actually very good, because that means that each of the pi sigmas in this integral is a valid solution to the optimization problem, right? Because it's a product state, it obeys all the polynomial constraints, and that's all we asked for. And finally, we can also show that you can choose one of those pi sigmas, and it will give you an upper bound, right? Because it's a valid solution that actually matches the lower bound in the limit, right? So you can literally construct the state in a way, and the lower bound matches exactly with the upper bound given by that particular state, which means that you're done, right? In the limit, you've actually converged to the true solution. Okay, so now relating things back to also this CLEP paper, they do something similar, but not quite the same. So they also extend the algebra, but they extend it by commuting generators. And these generators should mimic the expectation values when you let them act on the basis. Now, you cannot enforce this because you're optimizing also over these states. So you cannot directly tell the computer that gi should be equal to rho ai. So that's why I put it between brackets, but this is the idea behind it. And now, if you could do that, your polynomials in states also become linear, right? Because you could say, okay, if I have this condition that rho aij factorizes rho ai, rho aj, then you can just use, again, the linearity of a state to sort of move the brackets, and you can replace this rho aj by this generator. And again, your expression becomes linear, right? If you compare rho ai aj with rho ai gj, then your expression is fully linear. And they show that this also works. So except their proof technique is very different from ours. They prove some kind of positiv Stellensatz, which I'm not super familiar with how this literature works or how this theory works. So I'm not going to say too much about that. But it's still very interesting that around the same time they came with a very similar technique, so to say. So in physics, we know this kind of approach as scalar extension, Probably the physicists are more familiar with this expression. Okay, so to conclude, we can now solve these polynomial optimization problems by a hierarchy of relaxations that converges in the limit. And it has several applications in quantum information theory, in particular for the causal compatibility problem, but also for these nonlinear Bell inequalities, which you can apply in quite a lot of cases. And there's some open questions that we want to answer and we want to know about. For example, which of the hierarchies, the Clapp hierarchy or our hierarchy, which one is faster in convergence? They both converge in the limit, but you want to look at the finite steps as well in practice. And how are they related? So David also kind of mentioned this already, how they might be related, but we have to look at that in a bit more detail maybe. And secondly, for which of these causal structures is state polynomial optimization actually complete? Right. So we looked at the bilocal scenario where it works, star scenarios, that's where it works. In which cases does it work as well? I'm not so sure. And I'd be very happy to find out how that works. So thank you very much for listening. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Questions?
Yes, so I have a question related to your last question. So we always think in terms of what we call these networks. So you have the sources going to the parties and you don't do more. But of course, we could also imagine a circuit with more depth, right? Mm-hmm. Where maybe you have some unitary gate and you have measurement after two layers, right?
Yes.
And there also you could do inflation, mm-hmm. with the same idea. And we could try to do the same, right? What are all the probability distribution which could be obtained by this circuit with arbitrary dimensions, etc.?
Yes.
And then in your Lorentz matrix, you would include unitary operators, I guess, or stuff like this.
Right, so you could do that. And I think this was also the approach in the original quantum inflation paper. But there's another way of doing that. And that is by, it's a bit complicated maybe to to explain. But you can also think of a state in the middle as redistributing the original state that gets received. Right, so this local unitary, you can sort of map all of that to the end, so to say, to the final measurements. The only thing you need to do is then sort of regroup subsystems, and so the commutation relations become a bit more difficult. But so you need to figure out how to write down your algebras. But in the end, you can sort of write it almost again like a two-layer DAG. Except your commutation relations become a bit more involved. It's a bit hard to explain.
It's much more elegant than the way we did it. Much more.
I'm sort of puzzled by the definitive theorems. I've seen at some point I was interested in definitive type theorems. At some point, many, many years ago, I saw some quantum definitive type theorems. I think there is a classic by Stirmer.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Is this the same thing?
It's very closely related, yes. So sort of the difference between ours and
there's
Stirmer's.
Like Accardi, also Pistone and Holevor or something, I think, that did quantum definitive theorems in the 70s, early 70s.
Right. There were.
Stirmer is 69 or something.
I don't know the dates. Yeah, but that could be very true. Yes. So the difference between ours and theirs, I think, is mostly in the fact that we need a maximal tensor product here, which I deliberately did not mention.
Yeah.
But that makes. Well, in the end, the proof is very similar, but you have to kind of recheck that all of the steps go through.
Yeah. I mean, there's sort of a mechanism for doing definitive theorems.
Yes.
Sort of, you do this and you do that.
Yes.
So the one we built on is by Reinhard Werner and Raggio.
Okay.
And so Reinhard Werner has this reputation. He's an old school mathematical physicist. He turned one of the pioneering quantum information people. And he has this reputation that he always writes the last paper on a topic because he treats it in such generality that there's nothing left to be done. However, he did, his notion of tensor product was too narrow for us because these algebras that the optimizer can create for us, we have no control over them, so we need the generalization. So then we proved it, but then we didn't trust ourselves because we generalized the theorem by Reinhardt, that can't be true. And so I actually called Reinhardt and asked, why didn't you do that back then? And he was a bit embarrassed and said, we didn't think it was necessary.
Okay.
But then we trusted it. So then Reinhardt thinks it's possible, then it's probably true.
So Reinhardt again generalized something by Sturmer. So the Sturmer one is sort of this version, so to say, with the minimal tensor product. And Reinhardt glued this extra system on there, which we, again, here also don't use, but yes.
And also, one way of looking at the Definetti theorem is to say the Definetti theorem says that if you have these symmetries, then there is a latent variable.
U that is the measure of the latent variable.
Yes, and sigma is the latent variable.
And now comes the big thing that if you now read the Lasserre people, the Lasserre people, they optimize over varieties, but they don't directly optimize over varieties. They optimize over probability distribution on the variety.
Yeah.
And they don't even do that. They relax it, and they optimize over pseudo distributions. And this d mu, this measure over single particle states that appears in all the Definettis, that is the same mu as the latent variable, and it's the same measure on the variety that Lasserre people use. So in the end, all comes together. So that's a good consistency check.
Yes.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I don't know whether you've been thinking, the other thing, the theory of cumulants, I don't know whether you've ever seen any cumulant and cumulant tensors, which are describing multivariate properties of distribution. These are like moments, but they are sort of made in such a way so they are additive, so things become linear.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, the first cumulant of a distribution is the mean, the second is the variance, the third one is the skewness, the fourth one, the kurtosis, etc. And they have the property that if you have independent repetitions, they're additive. So things that looks to be nonlinear and look to be like, it's really essentially somehow, it's a way of taking logs. So you have these, so you make these products linear. Yeah. And I wonder, and some of these polynomials you wrote up, I can see, I don't know.
Yeah, it sounds like it's related. Yeah, it sounds like it.
They are, they're made. And this is because this, you can see cumulants as a way of linearizing, because they're sort of limits of inductive limits of tensor products or blah 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 something.
Mm.
I don't know.
So
makes sense.
To compute the square, you just compute square of A, you just compute A1 tensor A2, and you add the fact that you get the permutation which brings A2 to A1.
I had a quick naive question that I think yours somebody else can answer. When we talk about the Bell scenario, we know that it's going to be some linear constraints because we're eliminating that one latent variables. So I'm trying to remember what's the advantage of nonlinear Bell inequalities. Like, where would I sort of want to use a nonlinear Bell inequality? For CHSH, I know everything. That'll just be a relaxation. Is there some context in which nonlinear Bell inequalities are very useful?
That's a good question. I'm not so sure. I just try to put down some motivation for why this is useful. But
only the classical Bell scenario is described by linear inequalities. But the set of quantum correlations in the Bell scenario is not described by linear inequalities. Mm-hmm. And the optimization problem they opened with was trying to take this polynomial function and figuring out its quantum maximum. So it allows you to sort of explore quantum. The quantum set in terms of polynomials.
Good.
Yes, that's true.
All right, let's thank Lawrence again and go for it.